listening Dog Media.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Music, sport, history. Stories from the people of the city. The Manc Made Podcast with Jack Wood.
Hello and welcome to another Manc Made Podcast. I'm Jack Wood. I hope you're doing as well as you can be in these strange, strange times. You probably noticed I might sound a little different. That's because I'm recording this intro from my own room because we're trying to keep the lockdown locked down. That's all we're going to say about it, because this recording was from a couple of months before the lockdown, and we're going to have it as a bit of a, you know what, if you need something to think about that isn't what's going on in the world, this is perfect, because we had no idea what was happening when we recorded this. It's a little chat I had with Mark Lipman. Mark Lipman is the head honcho at Scruff of the Neck, which is an incredible label, music label, from Manchester. Mark will chat through how he's taken this label from just putting on a few gigs, a few small venues around Manchester, to becoming a massive business with 8 divisions. So let's see what we had to talk about. So, like, I guess what we should say at the start is congratulations on winning the Best Small Label Award from the Independent Music Awards. How did that feel?
The AIM Awards, yeah. It was nice to get some recognition because we're the only Northern company on any list.
Yeah.
So, like,
you're the first, company outside of London to win that award.
I don't know about historically. I just mean on the night when you looked at all the list of nominees on any award for industry, and we were the only Northern company on any of those lists. You had a load of Northern bands and stuff. Larkin's got a nomination as well, but we were the only Northern company. So when we won it as well, it was the first award of the night as well. So we were kind of like, it came up and then we won, and we were just on like a massive buzz for the rest of the evening, just necking a load of champagne and beers and that. So yeah, pretty proud of it. And but it funny thing, these awards, because you get this little metal thing that you stick in the office and it gathers dust a little bit in
there. Of course.
But what it really means, like, you know, all our logos online and stuff all changed to Scruff and that Best Small Label. It's on our email signatures, and it really does help business as well, because people just take that bit more seriously.
Because when did you win that? It's a few months back.
I think
now.
It was like September 2019.
And has it made a difference for you in terms of your business? Has people now started going, all right, we're going to take you more seriously, or were they not taking you seriously before? Is this just added to it, or is it one of those?
I think naturally when you're not from London, people sort of, I don't want to like be derogatory towards them and say there's a big issue, but there is an element of them not taking you as seriously.
No.
Because you're not in the mix, and if you've not got a London office, it's like, well, who are these? Whereas I think we're using it now to our advantage. And yeah, the award definitely validated us with that industry, because we're there in front of, you know, the head of BBC Music and people from major record labels. I mean, Johnny Marr got a Lifetime Award, I think, on the night, and Debbie Harry had an award. And so, like, you know, you get to go up on the stage in front of all these people, and it definitely validates you. People remember your bearded face, me and Mick.
Yeah. What does Best Small Label mean, by the way? Does that mean, like, is it the number of staff you have or the number of artists you look after? Like, what separates a big label from a small label? Is there such a thing as a medium?
I think it was number of staff, I think, on the label, because we had 3 of us at the time technically working the label.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the criteria. Mitch actually did the submission,
yeah.
Your friend Mitch,
yeah.
Our label manager. And we had to fit some criteria. It was just something like how long we'd been trading and the size of our team. But then in terms of like what made us the Best Small Label, I mean, I looked at our pitch versus some of the other labels, and I thought that Mitch put ours together really well. It had a lot of like factual stuff in there. You know, it was to the point about like the success we had on Spotify and Amazon Music and Deezer, the DSPs, which are highly sought after now in the new age of being a label. But then I think all the other stuff around, like, who was I speaking to? Someone who I think was on the board the other day, can't remember who it was, maybe I can't say.
Yeah.
But I was speaking to someone about it, and they said that they, when it came to making the decision, it was the fact that we had a multifaceted enterprise, and the fact that we do have a prolific live division promoting hundreds of gigs a year, and we have an in-house creative, and we have a festivals arm, and a production company doing sound, lighting, and touring, and that kind of thing. So, all those things, really.
You've got everything an artist really needs, especially like at the beginning, because it says on your website, it's the vehicle to take artist talent from hobby to career.
That's right. Yeah. Well, that we've got a couple of little jargony phrases we use to describe what we are. We say we're up to 360 because the 360 model is considered quite taboo to a lot of people. But what we say, we're up to 360 because we're a do-it-yourself till someone else can do it better for the artist. Mm. So, you know, for example, we'll always, when we take on a new act for development, we'll tend to book for them until we find them the right booking agent. Cassia, we talked about before, were a great example where I was doing all the concert booking and festivals for them. And then James Osgood and Greg Lowe at UTA took them on, James taking most of the lead on it. And he was just prolific. He got them touring the whole world, doing festivals across Europe. And he helped us get a North American agent as well. And that was just a prime example of pass on the booking when someone is going to take it up a level, you know.
The other thing is you say, obviously going back to this, because I find it really like an interesting thing to take. You say you take it from a hobby to a career, and what steps are there to do that? Like, is it that simple that you've got like a set plan and it can work with every artist, or do you have to sort of tailor it?
I think it can be pretty simple. Obviously, every journey is different for the artist because you have some that are, you know, that are taking the interest of all like the teenagers at school and college, and that tends to be the demographic. Like the pop stuff tends to gravitate more towards that age group, and then you might have a band that are like throwback to, you know, sounds from the past, and then naturally you get people who lived through the 70s and the 80s latching onto a band that are sort of reproducing that sound. So for that reason it varies. The phrase at the top of our website, the vehicle to take artistic talent from hobby to career, I had a chat with Paul actually before we came in here, saying, you know, oh, have these guys been signed? I went to watch a band last night called October Drift, and I said, have they been signed? And I said, technically, yeah. I said, I spoke to their booking agent and a partner management team last night, and they said, yeah, they've signed to someone with a label. So technically they've been signed, but does that mean you've made a career yet? I don't know that, and that we didn't go down that path with that band. But what I think taking a hobby to career means is ultimately making it so the band are earning enough money for it to be the job and they can have a living wage off it. Like, that's the first step, really. You know, Larkins are now a full-time band. By hook or by crook, they are earning enough money to just about live. I mean, living like students or grafting.
Yeah.
You know, grafting, it's still early on, but they are doing that band as their full-time job. And that's artistic talent from hobby to create. It doesn't matter if they're signed or not. You could do it independently as long as you got an audience, basically built a fan base and that support you.
How long did that take then, just out of like interest? Because like, let's say I've just started a band and I'm with some people and we're like, we want to make this full time. Like, how long did that like take, say, Larkins? Because Larkins have made a name for themselves. They're pretty well known now.
Yeah.
And does it need that sort of everyday recognition just to scrape by?
The length of time they've been a band, I mean, Josh and Dom formed the band in college.
Yeah.
So that was years and years ago. But it's like, when does a band really, truly get on the board, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like against all the other bands. I'd say really when we started taking it very seriously as a band was when they started selling out shows in Manchester. Like, I remember doing the band had sold out a show themselves before we started working with them at the Deaf Institute. And then I think when we got involved, I'd say that was when they sort of really were on the board then, you know, we got involved promoting them and helping manage them and stuff. And we started, you know, selling out big venues in Manchester. Like, we did the Club Academy, did like, you know, 550 tickets or whatever it was at the time. And we just kept gliding through the venues. The Gorilla, I remember that was a big moment. And then I think at that point, you're sort of taking yourselves really seriously because you're doing these, you know, statement venues for a small local band at the time. So I guess, like, to answer your question, it can be any length of time. You've got to be prepared to put years and years in if you believe in your art.
Of course.
You're not catfishing the bottom, and right? You hear it was like 10, 12 years or whatever they were doing it. Mm. Slow Readers Club, a band that, you know, have been massively important to my journey and Scruffy Neck's journey, are finally full-time on it. And Aaron turned 40 recently, the singer, and he was in a band with his brother called Immerta before the Slow Readers Club, and they were in another band before that. And I think they were called the Starkeys or something before that.
Yeah.
So really, it can take any length of time. You've got to persevere. I think the quickest you can do it, you can do it, you know, in a year if you catch fire or...
course.
But you've got to be prepared to graft, especially as a band, I think.
Take it through, yeah. So, Scruff of the Neck, how did that come about then? How did that start? How did you just sit down and go, I'm going to make a label?
I'll give you a little little sort of 90-second...
Yeah,
that always end up about
elevator pitch me.
The elevator, yeah, that's what Mitch called it, the elevator pitch. So I was in bands and stuff when I was younger, just like local bands, never really did anything that much. But I was very perseverant, like played loads of gigs all over the country to like three people each one. But I then lived above a pub in Manchester in my final year at uni called the Rampant Lion. It's a big gothic building in on Anson Road in just around Longsight near the MRI.
Yeah.
I said to the owner, because I was living above it and I was working in it, and I said, oh, I'll put some gigs on for you. I've always fancied doing it. And he was like, no, I'm not interested in that. I just want to sell pizzas and beers. Anyway, he wasn't selling enough pizzas and beers. So he was like, oh, go on, you can have a go at it on a Sunday night, because we don't really do anything then.
Course.
So I was like, go on, all right, I'll do it. So I got my mate who was studying sound at uni that I knew from school to come down, and we got a load of equipment from our rehearsal room. And then I said to the owner, I need you to buy me a mixing desk, because I can do everything, but we just need a mixing desk. So he gave us £70 and we bought this, he bought it for us, this 6-channel analog mixing desk, the worst thing, piece of equipment ever. But it got us through, and we could put a couple of microphones in, kick drum, aligning for keys and stuff. So, we managed to get enough to put gigs on in the back room in this pub. And that's how Scruff of the Neck was formed. It was a little show in a pub just outside Manchester. Went really well the first show, and he said, you can do it again, and he continued to pay us in equipment. So the next time he bought us a SM58 microphone.
Nice.
And then the next one, it was a kick drum mic, and then a 57 for the guitars. And so we just accumulated this equipment and this reputation of putting on these really cool gigs on a Sunday. People had, append tours, add it on at the end of tours and stuff, because it was always busy. Eventually, though, sadly, the pub... went out of business. I bought the PA system off him, and so we had this PA system and this amazing live setup with lights and all the mics you need and stuff, and these skills. So me and Chris then started running these gigs in the suburbs of Manchester, in places like Poynton, where I went to high school, which is actually in Cheshire.
Mm.
And we put like the rig into civic halls and sports clubs, and brought like bands from Manchester and the sound of Manchester and put it into these places for the kids. And that was great fun. It lasted for a bit and then it sort of fizzled out, and we started running gigs in the city centre. And then this is where the story really evolves, where...
What sort of venues were you going for?
The first one, always small. I always thought, ram out a small venue and make sure there's no space, so it's packed and like buzzing.
Yeah.
So we were running these gigs at the Attic, it was called, on Oxford Road. And I remember I learned very, very quickly that to run the best gigs, you need the best bands, the best local bands as a local promoter. To get the best bands, you need to add more value than just putting on a gig, because anyone can book a venue, put a poster up, do a bit of social media. So I took a real interest in everything outside of the gigs with the bands. Like, I started learning like how to distribute the music online, and I got a mate, I remember at one point, to come and do a music video for a band, and we recorded a track in a bedroom, and then we put it out on Scruff of the Neck Records.
So suddenly, from just putting them on in Manchester, being like, how do we make these stand out? You became more than, you were a promoter then as well as just a gig booker. You became a label because you were recording them. You were telling them, yes, how to do their online presence. And so it seemed to evolve naturally then,
yeah,
into a label.
Just like learn, it was like management, label, it's just artist development. It's all one and the same thing for me. And I just like wanted to do, I really got into these bands. There was one called The Quangos that I loved. I just wanted to do more for them than like put gigs on. I was like, why don't we do this? And I'd have meetings with them and come up with strategies and ideas for the music videos and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, and it just evolved from there. And now, we've got 8 limited companies in the group.
It's like a passion project that's got out of hand and become your life. But that's brilliant. That's exactly what jobs should be, really.
That is actually what it is, yeah. Because I was working in a bank, like while I was doing this, while I was building Scruff Up, obviously I wasn't making money, just really.
Taking a few from the side, putting it into the business,
Just every penny we made, and we still do it now. We just put it back into the business. And I was working a day job in Barclays for 7 years. And I was working on the train on Scruff, and then on my break, on my lunch, like anyone at Barclays will remember this. I remember me in the canteen just working. And I just never stopped, and I'd get home and do a few hours as well. It is a passion project that got out of hand, but it's working really well, and proud, very, very proud of it, and I wouldn't change it for the world. Very grateful.
So my question is, like, why aren't more labels based in Manchester? We've got the music. The music historically is from, like, the 90s seem to be dominated by Manchester artists. So why isn't there more labels based here?
Where are you based now, Jack?
London.
And where are you from?
Manchester.
This is the problem, right? So yeah. At the moment, like, we've...
Call me out.
It is... Sorry, mate. It was just to make... It is changing, though. It, yeah. You're up here. You know, fair play. So you've come up on a train to do this in Manchester. And, like... But I think the problem has been that a lot of industry is focused down in London. Like, all, you know, most of the radio gatekeepers and press. DSPs, like, you know, when we got into... Got a bit of support from Spotify, we'd go down and... You know, fortunately, Dexter really took an interest in our label, and he used to come and see me when he came up to Manchester. But that was probably one.
So Dexter's from Spotify, right?
He's just—I think he's just left. But he's he was doing a lot of the playlisting for guitar music, alternative music.
Nice.
And he really supported us. He found that we were getting these great new bands, and he used to put them on these influential playlists. And but yeah, I think the reason to answer your question that there's not more up north is because. Most of the industries, it is in London. It's changing a bit. The BBC have come up here, and ITV are in Leeds, I think, and stuff. So I think it is gradually moving a bit more up north. But all the labels and A&Rs and like big promoters are all based in London. So,
and what do you look for when you're signing these artists? Is there something like sparks you off that thinks, you know what, they're worth us working with them?
Yeah, I have an answer for this. I've got a. When I did a panel in Groningen in the Netherlands at Eurosonic, this Dutch production crew grabbed me in the conference centre and said and interviewed me on the spot. And then they asked me, what is it you look for in bands? So exact same answer. We look for three things. So the first thing is obviously talent, but that doesn't mean they have to be the finished article by any stretch. They just need to show that a bit of talent, like something that can develop, because that's our job to develop them. So talent, work ethic is the big one. Like we talked about this before we came on air, actually. Work ethic. You can't teach that. And then the third one's pretty simple. They've got to be like nice, good people.
Yeah.
I believe we're nice, good people. And it's very emotional, managing and developing bands. The music industry is very personal and emotional, because it's all, you know, for artists, it's their art. It's like their everything. And then it's exactly the same for us. Like my business is my art and my baby. And you have to, I think you have to get on. You don't have to be best mates as such, but like, I think we're very, very close to our artists on a personal level, very good friends with most of them as well. Like, and that's massively important, because that really motivates you. Like, there's nothing motivates me more than when my artists are like, not only being super professional and brilliant talents, but when they're like, nice, you know, come out for a pint for your birthday or whatever. It's they're the three ingredients, dead simple for me.
Have you ever had to then, like, and this might be a bit personal, gone, oh, we're getting on, do you know what, they got massive following, they're working really well, but I think he's a dick, or she's a dick. Has that happened? Then you have to go, do you know what, this is not worth our time. Like, they could be huge, but we're not going to enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes relationships in business or anywhere, they come to an end, don't they? And like, I wouldn't say it's ever been because someone's a dick. I know you were kind of just being flippant there, but like, I know what you mean. We have had to stop working with artists in the past because the relationship has just failed. I likened it to like, you know, when Mauricio Pochettino was like the golden manager of the Premier League at Tottenham.
Yeah.
And then in this season, he got sacked because it just stopped working. Like something broke down with his players, and it's hard to explain what it was, because you don't just go rubbish overnight as a manager.
No, of course. So
I think, yeah, we've had to stop working with artists, and it's always really sad because you're so invested, but because the relationships broke down, it's not because you don't respect each other, it's just you just lose that, like, I don't know, like a bit of the love, like maybe fall out of love or something.
Yeah.
It's really, really sad. I remember when I was managing, the first band I ever managed called Delamere, when I was just on the up, and I was learning everything, like, I was trying to learn everything with them, and, you know, fair play to them letting me have a go at it with them. And eventually I just decided I didn't want to do it anymore. I thought the relationship had broke down quite a lot, and I brought them into the office and just said, sorry, I just don't feel like I can do it anymore. And I remember getting picked up outside and crying in the car, like a proper sobbed. I was like really upset about it.
It's like a breakup.
It was like a breakup, yeah. And I remember thinking, I was in a relationship, you know, a secure relationship at the time, and I thought, oh, I'll never have to go through that again now. But I did. that day I was really, really upset. I've actually got back in touch with Delamere lately, and we're having a meeting this week. So
but, fingers crossed.
Yeah, but it was
a few really counselling sessions. You know, you'll be fine.
It's really, really, really sad and emotional. Like when you split with a band, it's like it's paternal. It's like a paternal relationship. It's also like a romantic relationship, like in the sense of how much it affects you.
You've invested in their art. You clearly enjoyed their music as well, and it's sad because you don't stop enjoying it. There's just a breakdown in the relationship.
I love the acts I work with. I love the music. Like I play it when I'm walking around or I'm at home. Like I play it to my little boy and stuff like that. Like. Mm. Whenever I've got a new song, whenever I get a new demo, I'm like elated. Like if I get a new demo in my inbox from one of my bands, I'm like buzzing. I just can't wait to listen to it. So yeah, it feels very, very emotional when you...
So we've mentioned a few venues around Manchester, but obviously the concern at the moment is these smaller venues that bands desperately need to start with are shutting down, venues are changing. Like Jimmy's shut not that long ago, and that was a great, and that only started up a couple of years ago. Is that a worry for you guys that maybe there's not enough funding going into these up and coming like venues that's allowing bands to then work through, or are we not seeing the bigger picture?
We need venue. I mean, one, and that was another thing that came up on the panel in London the other day was why is Manchester so vibrant? And my answer was that we've got loads of bands and we've got loads of venues. I don't know the facts. I think one of the guys in the office did work it out at one point because we were trying to do a big post at Christmas around Manchester being awesome. Mm. But we have like a significant number of venues for the size of our city. However, you know, I do think there is a responsibility from like the Arts Council and the government to maybe try and support venues, because I think, I'm going to contradict myself, aren't I? But like one problem is like we want to be able to put shows on for young people, people under the age of 18. But the minute you put a show on for people under the age of 18 in a venue, the venue then can't make the money on the bar. So that, unless they then charge a ridiculous venue higher price, they're basically losing money. So you find that you don't really have many venues that can do 14 plus shows underneath like 400-500 capacity. And that's a real problem.
I mean, there's a lot of historic venues that have managed to make themselves last throughout. Like, look at the Deaf Institute, it's been there for years. Albert Hall, as you said before. And then there's, what are they doing right that's made them become like part of the, well, part, when you think of Manchester, you think of them.
I don't know too much about it. One of my eight divisions isn't owning a music venue yet. Would like
is
to
that
be.
Something you're tempted by?
Yeah, the live guys really want to own a venue. Like we've looked into, you know, at one point we nearly took over a calendar for a venue in Manchester. We just didn't think the time was right. But at this moment in time, my knowledge is not as grand as it is on other subjects. But I would speculate that the venues that are succeeding, like Gorilla seems to do well.
Yeah.
I think from a business perspective, it's because they have they've a well-specced venue, well-staffed, well-run. The aesthetics are all right in there. Like when you go in, it's like nice and dark and the lights and everything's like...
It's got an atmosphere before the band comes on.
Yeah, it's immersive and like, you know, you feel like you're out when you're in there. And then they're very smart with the way they manage the calendars. So they have a balance of booking in-house club shows and stuff, and then also getting external promoters in. The guys, I think they're called Mission Miles now, or unless they've changed it again, who own / run the Albert Hall, Gorilla, Deaf Institute. They're all very, very efficient, very forthcoming with promoters, and like, you know, they're really quick to get back to help book stuff in, and they help you promote through all their means really well. So they'll put your stuff on the website, on mailers, and post to the venue and stuff. Like, they really, really care about the shows.
Well, it's clever of them in a way, because they've developed, like, they've got different size venues around the city that they can go, look, your band are at this stage, they play here. Oh, you managed to sell those tickets. You can go to the bigger one now.
Yeah.
So it's a business model. It's very clever of them to do it that way. And maybe is that why sometimes the more independent ones that can only afford certain things are just falling through every now and again?
Yeah, maybe. Like, goes back to, again, like, if you look at venues like Gulliver's and the Castle, which are like 100 cap and 80 cap, they're great for like an intimate show and a first step, maybe a first headline show for a local band in Manchester. We do loads of them. We've put most bands through those venues.
Do you see them as like a test venue then? Like if you're starting them off, like say there's a band that, because you don't just sign bands in Manchester, you've got bands from all over the country and you put gigs on. I know there's like a band you work with, Creeping Gene. Yeah. I think they've done stuff at like Gulliver's and the Castle. And is that sort of for you? You go, okay, you're in a new city. Let's see how you go in this venue. And then you guys can see them live as well.
Yeah, well, it goes back to what I said at the beginning about like, always wanting a gig to be full, like starting small, because I always want the gigs to be full. And that's why you should really start. Your first headline show should be as small and intimate as possible. Like, you want to, if you think you can sell 100 tickets and do an 80 cap venue.
Yeah.
Or 100 cap venue. But, like, you know, make sure that you sell it out and it's packed. And those venues are great for that, because to sell the castle out, you know, you need 80 tickets. It's doable. Like, I used to do that with my, you know, my mum, my nana and granddad used to come to gigs and stuff. And that I could sell all the 80 tickets just as a pretty rubbish local band. Like, so, like, you know, you can, but you can give yourself belief and sort of test yourself out in those environments by playing those smaller venues. So, it is a rite of passage. It's not as such a place, like, we don't think about it that much in the sense of it's, you know, like to audition them or anything. But it's a really good way of building an atmosphere without too much pressure on selling loads of tickets at an early stage.
And as you are one of Manchester's premium independent labels, as voted for, of course, is there any artists, do you feel like you have to get more maybe northern artists than you would, say, southern artists? Or is that just because this is where you're based? Do you feel like you need to promote that talent more because of where you're based?
Yes, I do, actually. I mean, I actually stopped working with an act. I was managing an artist from Brighton who was an amazing talent, grafter, and a very good friend of mine, really lovely guy. And we agreed to stop the management arrangement because he's based in Brighton and we just couldn't see each other.
Yeah.
And I know myself, I do most of the day-to-day management of the acts. That's like part of what I do, as well as being the CEO. I manage the artists. I'm very, very personal with the development of them. And not being able to see an artist is like, I can't do it. I just can't. I have to spend time with them. I don't spend enough time with them as it is. One of my objectives for this quarter is to try and spend more time with my artists. So I've got, you know, I'm trying to get like at least one face-to-face meeting in every 3 weeks or something. So to answer your question, yeah, we are now focusing more on northern talent, but it's not like a rule. It's more like a guideline. And, you know, if amazing talent comes up from London or Brighton or Berlin or LA, like if we find amazing talent that we just click with, then we'd move heaven and earth to make it work. But really, I'd say we are sort of focused on the north because we feel we can do the best job for artists in the north and we know the north. And I feel like as well, because we want to build this, like I want my aspirations for Scruff of the Neck for it to be mentioned alongside Factory as culturally essential to the city. I want American people to, when they hear them from Manchester, to mention Scruff of the Neck and not just Factory. For that reason, I think we do need to be seen as developing northern talent.
I think that's a perfect place for us to end, really. Incredibly ambitious and strong. Thanks so much, Mark.
Great, thank you for having me.